It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Netflix series Making a Murderer got people around the world talking about a Wisconsin murder conviction. Our guest says the series and the cases it followed exposed a broken system of criminal justice here in the state.
First, Wisconsin could become the first state in the U.S. to drug test people seeking Medicaid coverage. Under the federal application, anyone who fails or refuses to take the test could be ineligible for benefits.
Governor Walker has said the move would help the state identify people who need help dealing with addiction. Critics have said he's playing politics with public health.
Jamila Michener is with us now. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She also has a background in public health. Jamila, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I want to start with what the application includes. Why does the state need to apply for a waiver with the federal government to implement these rules that it wants?
Well, Medicaid is a federal state program, and so it's funded by the state to a certain extent, but a large portion of the funds also come from the federal government. And so when states are deciding to do new things with their Medicaid programs, they need the go-ahead from the federal government. And for a long time, this is something that the federal government has not been interested in giving folks, states, the go-ahead for. And so had Wisconsin proposed something like this under an Obama administration, it wouldn't have happened. But now state governors are seeing an opening, and they're realizing that things like work requirements and drug testing are possible, potentially, under the Trump administration.
So where does Wisconsin stand against a backdrop of other states who might be considering similar measures?
Well, Wisconsin is the first state that has sort of explicitly proposed drug testing. And so in that way, it's a leader. And in general, I mean, Wisconsin is one of the states that hasn't expanded its Medicaid program, as many other states have over the last few years. And it's also one of the states that, though it relies, heavily, as all states do, on federal funding, has in many ways tried to sort of chart its own path and doesn't sort of follow the lead of the federal government always. And so it's a really interesting and unique place. It has a pretty large Medicaid program. So we're talking about over, you know, a million people. And it's also an expensive program, right? So 1.2 million people enrolled and over $8 billion a year. So this is a really important policy that helps a lot of people, most of whom are low income.
Well, Indiana has tried something similar, hasn't it? What is the status of that program?
Well, yeah. So Indiana has tried some similar things, not with respect to drug testing, but with respect to things like monthly premiums and these sort of behavior incentives that say if you do these particular things, if you go to the doctor, if you instead of ER, et cetera, you'll get benefits. And so a lot of the things that have been done by other states that have taken the kind of most conservative approach, like Indiana, Wisconsin is now wanting to do. But Wisconsin is also adding quite a lot on the top, right? So the idea of a time limit for Medicaid eligibility, where you could only be on the program for a certain amount of time and then you have to be off for 6 months, so 48 months on and then 6 months off, and then this idea of drug testing. These are things that other states have sort of maybe floated around before in a really non-committal sense, but now Wisconsin is taking quite a step forward by saying, we want this to be policy, and that's a big deal.
And in terms of the thinking behind this for lawmakers in Wisconsin, the idea is that people would get drug tested and get into treatment if they were found to test positive for drugs, and then eventually this could help them be employable down the road. Is there any data out there that would suggest that this is a sound reasoning, something that would work?
Not at all. So part of that is because this is the first time that we're seeing this kind of drug testing regime be proposed for Medicaid. So we have no idea what the consequences of that will be. But we have reasons for being suspicious that it will be beneficial if we look at other programs like cash assistance programs, temporary assistance for needy families, which is what most people think of as welfare, where we've seen states like Michigan and Florida and North Carolina implement these programs where they're going to drug test welfare beneficiaries. And what we found, especially in the last few years, is that very few people are testing positive, right? Very, very few. Actually, in Michigan, the pilot program that they've had going for about the last year, I don't believe that there's been one person who has tested positive yet. And maybe someone has popped up in the last few months. And in North Carolina, in most of these places, there are fewer than 1% of people who are testing positive. For Medicaid, it's a bit of a different case, and it's a bigger deal because there are so many more people. So we're talking about a program nationwide that has 70 million plus people and over 1.2 million just in Wisconsin. So this is a lot of people potentially. And there's no reason to suspect that trying to help people through this particular mechanism is the most effective way. Medicaid beneficiaries are already among the most vulnerable people around. And so to say that we're going to subject them to extra scrutiny, and it's not just that, you know, someone tests positive and then we help them. If you refuse to take this test, or if you test positive and then don't want to go to drug treatment, you will be removed from the program. And so there's a possibility that this is really going to be used as a punitive tool that's not just helping people in need of help, but that is also taking something away from people if they refuse the particular kind of help that the state is offering them.
We're talking with Jamila Michener right now, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University, talking about Wisconsin's application to drug test recipients of Medicaid for those benefits. And you mentioned that when we look at drug testing for welfare recipients in other states, it hasn't turned up a lot of positive tests. And there are some critics who say that it's pretty easy to manipulate these drug tests in some cases. So is this something that could have some structural flaws from the beginning, or at least challenges to overcome to get accurate results?
Certainly. I mean, there's a couple of things. One is about manipulating the test, which is, you know, what we might think of on the part of people who want to get around what might be, you know, positive results. But the other concern is that these tests themselves can be flawed and can produce false positives, right? Especially for a group or a population that is much more likely to be sick and to be medically needy. So these folks may be using a range of drugs anyway as prescribed by doctors, and it's not clear that we're going to be able to sort out who is testing positive because there are drugs that they're prescribed or have been prescribed, even if the prescriptions have perhaps expired or what have you. But we're dealing with a population that is more likely to be medicated in the first place and then saying that we're going to drug test them. And even outside of that, it just happens, right? False positives happen. And unfortunately, this is a case where if a false positive happens and someone says, but I'm not doing drugs and I don't want to go to this treatment program, well, if they don't go, they could risk getting kicked off of the program. You know, another risk when we just think about the potential fiscal costs of this is that we might be testing a lot of people and getting very few positives, and so we're paying to test many people for no reason. And even when we get a positive, it's not clear that that means that drug treatment is necessary. So it may not be great for people to sort of smoke marijuana, but some people do. And if you have, it doesn't follow that you need to go through a drug treatment program and that you have a serious problem, right? And if we say that every person who tests positive needs to go through what can be a very expensive program, it's going to potentially cost the state a lot of money. And it's not clear that it's going to help much of anybody. And there are better ways of more specifically targeting people who need help, right? Besides mandating for a whole group of people that involves a million plus folks, even though, I mean, there's a little bit more targeting. This is specifically for childless adults. But that's still a really large group of people. And this is just a blunt instrument. It's a broad brush. And we can do better as far as policy is concerned if we want to figure out a way to help people who have substance abuse problems.
And you were mentioning that these are changes that would affect only childless adults. So do you think that mechanism does something to maybe ameliorate some of the challenges that could face children, that could make people going through these programs more vulnerable? Is it enough, that mechanism, to just apply it to childless adults?
Not at all. I mean, many of the childless adults who are on Medicaid are still people who they may not technically be disabled, but they may have serious health problems, or they may just be less healthy than the rest of the population. And they're still quite low income, right? There are people who are living in poverty. And so to assume that childless adults for some reason should be targeted on account of the fact that essentially on account of the fact that they're poor and they need help with health care coverage, to assume that and target them on that basis, there's really no sort of evidence that justifies that. If we want to figure out whether people need help with substance abuse treatment, we can do that. We can do that by encouraging doctors and healthcare providers to screen and ask and offer that kind of help. We can do that by encouraging caseworkers and others to screen and offer that kind of help. And we can do it on a basis that's voluntary and in a way that's comprehensive by reaching out to these populations and letting them know what's available to provide them with help. And that doesn't have to have a punitive element. It doesn't have to have an element that says either you do this or, right? Instead, we could treat childless adults on Medicaid like adults who, if they need help and they're offered it, can take advantage of that, and not like people who need to be told what to do and threatened with having really valuable benefits removed unless they cooperate.
Jamila Michener is with us right now. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University.
You can join the conversation about drug testing Medicaid recipients in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Governor Walker's administration crafting a plan to do that, heading toward public comment and an application to the federal government. What do you think of this idea, drug testing some Medicaid enrollees? Do you think they should be tested, or do you think it's an invasion of privacy? Do you have worries about this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about Wisconsin applying for a waiver that would allow the state to require a drug test from any residents seeking Medicaid coverage. Jamila Michener is with us. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should people who want Medicaid be drug tested, this would apply as planned to childless adults using Medicaid. Why do you support this idea, or why do you not? What benefits do you think drug testing could potentially provide to people here in the state applying for Medicaid? Call in now at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jamila, you were saying earlier that you see some challenges, you have some reservations about this plan. But when we look at a goal that the legislature in Wisconsin has, which is to move people off public assistance and get treatment for drugs so that they are eligible for jobs and can hold those jobs, is there data about what does work?
Yeah, well, I mean, interestingly enough, the most effective way to help people is to actually provide them with what they need, and to do it in a way that is as less rather than more punitive. So one of the things that we know, for example, about health is that when people are healthier and when they have access to health care, they're more likely to be employed. And we also know that when programs do things like drug testing, et cetera, it has a negative effect on utilization. It turns people away, even people who may not be drug users, right? Because it's the idea of their privacy being invaded and the idea that there's an assumption that they're under suspicion. So for all of the people who are turned away and who don't utilize Medicaid benefits because of this, their health then is in danger, and that makes it less likely for them to be able to be independent and for them to be able to work. The other thing is that many of the folks who are on Medicaid are working. We don't actually have a huge problem with Medicaid beneficiaries who are able-bodied being unemployed. A lot of those folks are working, either full-time or part-time, and many of them that are not are either ill, disabled for various reasons, or temporarily unemployed or in school, right? And so the question is, for the small subset who are not working, why? And is it because many of them are out there abusing drugs, or is it because they're having challenges finding employment? And if it's an issue of the latter, then we really need to look at the job market and at wages and at what's available. And it's really easy to scapegoat low-income people on a government program and say, why don't they just go work? And it's much harder to think about, A, are they not working, or is that just an assumption? And B, for those that are not working, why? And how can we really get to the root of that?
Let's go to our callers now. We have Chris joining us first in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with everything that your guest is saying here. It just doesn't make any sense to drug test welfare recipients. And I feel that it's really targeting people that are mostly using marijuana also, because most hardcore narcotic drugs like methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and such, those are going to be out of people's systems within a day or two. And yeah. If people know, if they happen to be on welfare and they are using drugs, they're going to be smart enough to get off of those for the day or two, cleanse their systems out. But marijuana is going to be staying in people's systems, you know, a lot longer. So most of the positive tests are going to be coming from marijuana. And just because somebody's using marijuana doesn't necessarily mean that they have a drug problem. In my opinion, it's no different than, you know, somebody's using alcohol or tobacco.
Chris, thank you so much for calling and for sharing that. And Chris saying there are ways to get around this, and maybe this is targeting marijuana users, and maybe this gets into the debate over kind of marijuana legalization, what the uses and aspects of that are. What do you say to that argument, Jamila?
I think it's a good point. I mean, I think that when we look at public opinion data on a national level, the majority of the American public is fine with marijuana, right? And regardless of how we might feel about it individually, right? I'm a teacher. I wouldn't tell my students go smoke marijuana. But if we're talking about a drug that, you know, many people use and that the American public as a whole doesn't have a problem with, and it likely will be the main thing that people are getting snagged on. One other thing I would add is that there are racial disparities in kinds of racial and class disparities in the kinds of drugs that people use. And we know that if marijuana is the drug that most people are getting snagged for, that might lead to other kinds of disparities. Whereas the other drugs that are sort of the ones that we might be concerned about in terms of people who have really serious substance abuse issues, this isn't really going to get at that. So as I said before, it's a blunt instrument. It's attempting to address a pretty specific problem, but with a mechanism that is really too broad to do that effectively.
Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to move next to Anna in Milwaukee. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What did you want to share?
Oh, I'm commenting regarding the fact that drug addiction and alcohol abuse are considered an illness. So I'm just wondering, is Walker then going to be paying for the recovery for these people, or is this going to be part of a demographic that just is kind of pushed to the side and hidden behind a veil?
Anna, thank you for that. And what do we know about treatment options when someone might test positive on one of these tests, of the quality of the treatment and the expense of the treatment, and who ends up with that bill?
The interesting thing with the proposed changes to Medicaid is that they are also trying to provide more for people in terms of treatment and coverage, so that, you know, when folks are testing positive, they have the option to pursue treatment. Now, whether treatment is effective is a completely different question, and that varies substantially depending on the kind of treatment program that we're talking about and depending on the person and what their specific problems are. It's good that there is an impetus to try to address this problem and try to help people who have serious substance abuse issues, and Medicaid providing coverage for that is great. But to do it in this particular way, I think, is more problematic. And the other thing that's important to pick up is that, you know, if somebody has smoked marijuana, it doesn't mean that they should be going through substance abuse treatment programs. And if they end up being funneled through these programs, which are quite expensive, then we could end up spending a lot of time treating people, or a lot of money treating people who have minimal issues. And that might sort of take away from the resources we have to really help people who have more significant issues.
Well, Anna, I appreciate that call. And another quick call here from Jim in Hayward. Jim, hi.
Hi. I appreciate your guest's comments about being a blunt instrument. And she's accurate, but in a different way. It's a blunt political instrument. It is being used by the governor to run for re-election for the third term to appeal to his base. It's not designed to help the community or root out AODA issues. In fact, this experiment was done in Michigan at great expense with very limited numbers of people being found to be, you know, using or violating the policy that was implemented. Again, I agree with your comment, your guest comment. It's a blunt political instrument, and I'll be interested in her answer off the air.
Jim, thank you for that. And Jamila, your comments on that. And we've got this public comment period opening up. Is the public usually on board with these measures? Is it going to work from that perspective?
Oh, yeah. Those are both things I was hoping to get to. So the first thing is absolutely this is a political instrument. And absolutely that's a problem because it's not the kind of politics that's aimed at helping people. In fact, part of what my research does in a book that I've just finished that's coming out soon shows that in states that have some of these more strict policies, it actually depresses the political participation of Medicaid beneficiaries. So when you treat people on Medicaid like they're criminals, and when it's the government doing that, it doesn't make them want to participate in politics. And so the folks whose voices we really need to hear when we're thinking about policies like this, the people who it will affect, and perhaps the people who, some of whom will not be voting for Scott Walker, they're going to be turned away politically by this kind of policy. So not only is it political brinkmanship or game playing or what have you for, you know, purposes that have nothing to do with helping people, but it has implications for democracy that are really disturbing, which is why people should get out to these public hearings. You know, in other states like Pennsylvania, when they try to, for example, attach work requirements to Medicaid, a lot of nonprofit and other advocacy organizations got people out to these hearings. And it makes it clear to the folks in charge that there's a large group of people who are not for this. And the more people who can show up to those hearings to say, we're not up for this and we're going to stand against it, the better if it's the case that this is how folks feel. And so it's really going to be important to take a political stand. And I hope that there's activity going on the grassroots level in Wisconsin that's going to get people really swarming those hearings and sending a strong message.
We leave it there, Jamila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jamila Michener, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University.
The Netflix series Making a Murderer drew international attention to the murder trials of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey.
The disappearance of Teresa Halbach remains a mystery.
Mr. Avery's blood is found inside of Teresa Halbach's vehicle.
Steve, everybody's listening. What do you want to say today?
I'm innocent.
If convicted, Stephen Avery will spend the rest of his life in prison.
We found a key.
That key was scrubbed and his DNA was placed on it.
This is really strange.
What's going on here?
From the trailer there, Making a Murderer highlighted flaws in the prosecution, and the show got people talking about whether or not Avery and Dassey were guilty of the crimes they were convicted of.
Our next guest says there's a bigger story here beyond the details of the case. He says the series highlights serious flaws in Wisconsin's criminal justice system that lead to bias against defendants in criminal trials.
Michael Cecchini joins us now. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. He blogs at The Legal Watchdog. He's the author of a number of books on the legal system. His latest is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. He joins us now from our studio in Milwaukee. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You start your book with a reference to a different TV show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and describe Wisconsin from a defendant's perspective as a hellmouth when it comes to criminal justice. A hellmouth. Why is that?
Well, that's, as I put in the introduction, there are so many bizarre things that happen here. Now, I'll admit that practicing in Wisconsin, other criminal defense lawyers and I, we always think we have it far worse than other states. I'll admit a lot of these things do happen in other states, but the fact is I'm here in Wisconsin. I see and live through this stuff all the time, and I give several examples of it, recent Wisconsin case law, recent things that have been in the headlines. So I think we are, especially compared to our neighboring state, Minnesota, we do have a very massive, aggressive criminal justice system. That probably, I would say, justifies the name Hellmouth.
and you look at that system through the lens of the trials of multiple trials, actually, of Stephen Avery and the trial of Brendan Dassey. We won't spend too much time on the particulars of those cases, but can you briefly recap what happened in their cases?
Sure. Stephen Avery's first case, about 20 years before his second conviction, he was actually convicted of a rape and assault of Penny Bjornstad, and that was based on erroneous eyewitness identification. And it really was not the accuser's fault. It was due to repeated suggestive identification procedures by the police. Now, in Wisconsin, we've had a number of changes in the law where certain things are highly disfavored and not allowed anymore. So there has been a lot of reform in this area. We don't allow show-up procedures anymore where we bring a suspect or a picture of that suspect singly to a crime victim and say, this is the guy, isn't it? That's a very suggestive way to get an identification, and it's a very unreliable way. That's kind of the highlight of Avery's first trial. Of course, the second trial involved two defendants and two different trials. It was, I should say, a single victim, Teresa Halbach, two defendants, two different trials. And that was for the one that I believe the documentary probably spent 9 of its 10 episodes on the Teresa Halbach case, which resulted in that case, there actually was physical evidence. It did not hinge on an eyewitness identification. And Avery was convicted. And then the thing about Dassey's case, he was convicted without any physical evidence, without an eyewitness identification, almost entirely based on his confession, which, as many of your listeners will probably know, that conviction has now been reversed, and we are awaiting the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision as to whether that reversal of the conviction will be upheld.
And throughout your book, you lay out ways in which the things that we see done on Making a Murderer highlight what you see as deeper problems. And I want to spend a lot of our time looking at some of those specific issues. And here's one. This sounds a little technical, but you say this is a big deal. The way we talk about the burden of proof to our juries and our jury instructions in Wisconsin is different than it works in a lot of states, and it can bias juries against the defendant. Can you explain that?
Sure. The burden of proof in a criminal case, by the way the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Constitution, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But what is that? It depends on how you define it for the jury. Whenever there's a criminal trial, a jury will get a jury instruction read to them on the burden of proof, and then in most cases, certainly where I practice, they'll get a copy of that instruction. So the burden of proof is only as strong as it's defined. You can label it whatever you want. The problem with Wisconsin's burden of proof on jury instruction is that it discusses reasonable doubt at length, and that in itself, it has several flaws. Other states have rejected much of our language that we use as being unconstitutionally low burden of proof. But Wisconsin's biggest problem is this. The jury's instruction concludes by saying, don't search for doubt, search for the truth. And in my opinion, and I have reasons for holding this opinion, which I'll give in a second, but that lowers the burden of proof to a mere preponderance of the evidence standard. If you think something's probably true, then you are going to convict. Now, compare that to the state of Vermont, their jury instruction. It says that if you find that the defendant is probably guilty, you must find him not guilty if you have a reasonable doubt about the evidence. So they have a much better jury instruction that accurately reflects the burden of proof. Now, that's kind of obvious just from reading the two instructions. It's always been obvious to defense lawyers. We've hated that instruction for a long time. Fans of Making a Murderer might remember from episode 3, there was a psychologist, Lawrence White. He and I have done a lot of two controlled studies and a lot of research on this burden of proof instruction. And in controlled studies, we found that mock jurors who receive Wisconsin's burden of proof instruction convict at a much higher rate than jurors who receive a standard burden of proof instruction. In fact, mock jurors who receive Wisconsin's burden of proof instruction convict the same as jurors who receive no reasonable doubt instruction whatsoever. So it's a real problem in the state. Larry White and I, he's a professor at Beloit College in the psychology department. We've published on this extensively. I've asked our jury instruction committee here in the state to change this and just have a simple burden of proof instruction that says you have to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or you know if you can't do that, you have to acquit. So we're trying to make changes on that. I don't know how receptive our jury instruction committee is going to be here in the state, but we've done a lot of research on it. We've published on it. We've done controlled studies, and to me, that's the single biggest problem we're looking at here in the state, is we are convicting defendants all over the state by a mere preponderance of the evidence standard, and it's not constitutionally appropriate.
Talking to Michael Cecchini. He's the author of the new book, Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. I want to move on to another point you tackle in the book, and you mention it actually in the case of Brendan Dassey. The way suspects are interrogated, self-incrimination, confessions. A confession seems like it should be rock-solid evidence, but you say the way we handle that in Wisconsin and elsewhere, I think, can subject that to some doubt.
Yeah, the documentary, unfortunately, it couldn't. I mean, it just doesn't have the time to cover all these issues in depth, but they did cover his confession. There were a number of problems with it. It was contradicted by all the physical evidence. The many, if not most, and some people would say all of the facts, either were fed to Dassey by the police. And one of the reasons that it's been reversed, the district court, the federal district court reversed the conviction because you're looking at not an adult here, but a child who had some learning disabilities, and he was highly suggestible, and he trusted the authority figures. I've read all of the transcripts of his interrogations, and to me, the biggest thing that stands out are the false promises that were repeatedly made to this kid while he was being interrogated. They told him, look, you know, we're cops, yeah, but not right now. We're fathers. We have sons your age, and I'd like to come over there and give you a hug. Now, you can really help yourself by just talking here. And then they proceeded to feed, you know, facts to him and eventually got him to adopt some of those facts. So there were a lot of false promises telling him that anything he says, you know, the Miranda warning tells us, hey, anything you say can be used against you. No sooner did they give that warning, and sometimes they didn't even give a Miranda warning at all for some interrogations. But and in the interrogations where they did give the Miranda warning, they quickly contradicted that. And instead of after telling him anything you say can be used against you, they hammered away repeatedly that, look, anything you say can help yourself. You're a great guy. This is your chance, you know, to help yourself. So they completely reversed that and overcame Miranda in that way. So Dassey's interrogation, it just has so many problems. I've touched on a few of them. It was just a disaster from start to finish. It was a multi-part interrogation over about a two-day period, often without Miranda, with leading questions, with false promises. And add to that, you're doing this to a 16-year-old child who trusts you. So that's why the confession that it produced was contradicted by all the physical evidence. It's just, I don't think there are many people that really believe that the confession was true.
Talking to Michael Cecchini, he is a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. His new book is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you watched the show, did it raise questions for you about how defendants are treated in criminal court and how evidence and eyewitness testimony are handled? If you've been involved in a criminal case as a defendant, a victim, an attorney on either side, do you see problems with the way things work in Wisconsin? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about Wisconsin's criminal justice system. Our guest says the Netflix series Making a Murderer highlights a lot of flaws that stack the deck against defendants. Michael Cecchini stays with us. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha, and his new book is called Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Share your questions, maybe your experiences when it comes to criminal justice in Wisconsin. Do you think the deck is stacked against defendants? What kind of changes would you like to see? Or what do you think is working right? And did Making a Murderer raise questions about how things work when you watched it? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Michael, I want to get into at least one more area. The idea of this being information going out to the public, the trial by media, and potential jury contamination.
Right. That was a big problem. Well, it was a big problem for Avery, I think, or Avery. You'll remember some of your viewers will remember Jerry Buting saying how 129 of the 130 juror questionnaires came back and they indicated something like they believe that Avery was probably guilty or something to that effect. There's actually an ethics rule against that. It doesn't allow a prosecutor to talk about a defendant's alleged confession or about the test results of physical evidence and things like that. And anyone who's seen Making a Murderer knows that that happened. Ken Kratz and the sheriffs and other law enforcement agencies did that. The reason they did that, this was actually an issue that was litigated. It wasn't featured on the documentary, but there's an exception to the ethics rule that they can use that to counter adverse publicity. So they argued that, well, because Stephen Avery said that, well, I've been framed, I'm innocent, that they could get into all those things. Now, the question then becomes, well, what about Brendan Dassey? His trial was certainly impacted as well, and to my knowledge, he did not do radio or television interviews or make any such statements. So I think the documentary did a great job of showing how this pretrial publicity can really poison a jury pool against the defendant. It happened, I think, for both defendants, and it was nicely illustrated in the documentary. And, you know, in jury selection, we lawyers, we try and weed out jurors who have formed opinions on that, but unfortunately, the law pretty much allows any juror to sit on the jury. They do not have to give an unequivocal claim that they are not biased, and we certainly don't require that jurors haven't seen or heard anything about a case. So it's a real problem, and it's a difficult problem for defense lawyers to deal with when they're in trial and selecting that jury.
Let's go to our callers now. Elizabeth is on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I work with teenagers, and I just, when I watched that episode on Making a Murderer when they were questioning him, I just had the worst pit in my stomach because I could see that happening to any one of my students and just being brainwashed like that. I thought it was shameful. And I'm kind of wondering, now that the investigators, like, what is it, 10 years down the road, do they recognize that? And can they go back and say, we made a huge mistake? Like, I wonder if they can even sleep at night, because they have to know that what they did was so, so wrong.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. And Michael, I've talked to other people about DNA exonerations in the past where people who did confess in similar situations ended up being exonerated, found innocent, despite a confession because of DNA evidence. So how manipulable are we in these situations?
Yeah, I mean, there's numerous cases that prove that. People do falsely confess to things and they are later exonerated for it with DNA evidence. Now, just think of all the cases where, you know, the vast majority of criminal cases do not involve DNA evidence, so we're never going to be able to completely prove our innocence. So how often is this happening? We know there are a lot of reversals, but we don't know the magnitude of how often this happens. Now, to Elizabeth's point, she's absolutely right. When you take someone of that developmental level in that age, they view these people as authority figures. And to help Dassey along, they even told him, as I said, look, we're here for you, buddy. You're like, you know, they said, we're not here as police. We're fathers, too. And he would have said anything they told him to say. And you can see this where they repeatedly ask him, come on, something happened to her head, Brendan. What happened to her head? And he keeps guessing and guessing and guessing. And then he doesn't get it right. And then eventually they fill in the blanks for him. And they said she was shot in the head. Who shot her? And then, you know, then of course he agrees with whatever they say. Now, if I can just real quickly answer Elizabeth's other question about, you know, how can they sleep at night? You know, if you read the interrogation transcripts and look at some of the other police reports in this case, some police investigators actually believe that they know the truth. They think that their experience tells them when someone is lying. You know, they were convinced because Dassey reportedly lost weight and because he had been crying a lot. They were convinced, well, this has to be because of the gnawing guilt he's feeling for aiding Stephen Avery. They jumped to that conclusion. They were highly confident and they believed it. They still believe it. If you look at Making a Murderer, and some of those detectives or some of those police officers that were interviewed, sheriff's department employees and deputies, they are not convinced that Avery was innocent of the first crime 20-some years ago. So some people, you know, maybe isn't limited to police officers and detectives. Some people just believe they know things, and you're not always going to change their mind. Some people, no doubt, they will change their mind. Other people won't once they buy into a theory or a theme. There's really no changing it.
Let's take another caller. We've got Dennis on the line in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I have no opinion as far as the Avery or the Dassey case. I have been a jury member in another criminal trial, and the judge told us to not try to find a doubt. And I thought, well, if we don't try to at least explore the edges of doubt, how do we know how far to go with this case? So I questioned various things in my mind, but then when the prosecution and the defense didn't come up with these things I thought, well, I can only base my finding on what was presented.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Do you think this is a common experience for a juror, Michael?
I do, and Dennis, thanks for that call. That's one of the things that I'm trying to get changed here is our jury instruction that says don't search for doubt, search for the truth. Dennis brings up a good point. As a criminal defense lawyer, I don't have the time. I might be limited to 20 minutes in closing argument. I might not have the time to bring up all of the problems with the state's case. Now, Dennis is bringing up a scenario where, hey, I thought of real serious problems I have, but yet it wasn't raised by the lawyers, so does that mean I'm searching for doubt? The judge told me not to search for doubt. Our jury instruction, in my opinion, and there's now empirical evidence to support it, is unconstitutional. There are other states that say it is the jury's duty to evaluate the evidence for reasonable doubt. And if there's reasonable doubt, you have to find the defendant not guilty. So I feel for Dennis's position there. He was put in a tough spot thanks to our state's, presumably he was talking about a Wisconsin jury trial because he virtually quoted our state's jury instruction. Our state has an unconstitutional burden of proof, and I think Dennis just highlighted that.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We're talking to Michael Cecchini. His new book is Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. Want to get into the idea of eyewitness testimony being a problem. You brought that up in reference to Stephen Avery's first trial. Again, this, I imagine, from a jury perspective, if you've got somebody in a courtroom saying, yes, that's the person, I identify them, I saw them, that's going to be pretty effective. But there's doubt about that.
Yeah, controlled studies show that few things are more persuasive than a witness taking the witness stand and confidently pointing the finger and saying, hey, that's the guy who, you know, stole my purse or battered me or whatever the crime is. And there's controlled studies, however, that show that eyewitness testimony just isn't reliable. We tend to be overconfident in our memories of things. And on top of that, we saw this illustrated in Making a Murderer. Sometimes things happen after the event that increase our confidence level. For example, the police may show a photograph of one person and say, this is the guy, isn't it? And then the victim says, yeah, I think that is the guy. And they say, good job, you know, good job. And a lot of times there's verbal and nonverbal cues that give feedback to that victim. And then the victim becomes more confident in eyewitness identification. So eyewitness identification, it's persuasive to a jury, but it's not necessarily reliable in many cases.
Time for one more caller. Daniel is with us in Toma. Daniel, hi.
Hello. Yeah, our kind of like, I think our colony is just like, I don't know if it's the same as Taylor or how can you say it is, they neuralize and like, you know,
I'm not hearing you very well, Daniel. I've got a bad connection. I'm not making out what you're saying. Sorry about that. Daniel, thanks for trying to call in, though. Michael, what kind of reforms would you like to see? You say some things have changed in Wisconsin, but not all. What do you think would be at the top of your list?
Well, the top of my list is something I've already asked the jury instruction committee to change, and that's our burden of proof. If we could have a burden of proof instruction like Vermont's, which tells the jury, if you have a reasonable doubt, you must find the defendant guilty, even if you think he is probably guilty. That distinguishes between preponderance of the evidence and the high burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would love to see that change. I've published on that with Larry White. He and I have done controlled studies, and we've shared that with the jury instruction committee, and we're hoping for some legal reform there. Beyond that, it would be tough to say. There are a number of things. I would say the second thing I would choose would be the wrong person defense. The reason I first wrote this book is something Jerry Buting said in the documentary. He said, well, you know, we'd like to tell the jury who we think did this crime, but the judge really tied our hands on that. And what he was talking about is Wisconsin's third-party defense law, also known as the wrong person defense. It's incredibly difficult for a defendant to put on evidence of innocence or evidence that another person committed the crime. The law is very restrictive in that way. It poses very high burdens on the defendant and makes it very difficult to put on that defense. So I would like to see some reform in that area as well. But I think without a doubt our burden of proof jury instruction is the biggest problem.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
We've been talking to Michael Cecchini. He's a criminal defense attorney in Kenosha. He's the author of a number of books. His latest, the one we've been talking about, is called Convicting Avery, The Bizarre Laws and Broken System Behind Making a Murderer. You can still keep sharing your thoughts on the issues he raised. And we've got a link, by the way, to a piece he wrote based on some of the work he did for the book. You can find that and share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've had an experience as a defendant, a victim, a witness, a juror, or on the law side of things, on either side of the court case. We'd love to hear your experiences there. Again, that's all at the Central Time Facebook page.
And that is the haunting cry of the Australian dingo. And a dingo is in the news today after winning an international competition.
The competition, Most Interesting Genome. According to Smithsonian Magazine, biotech company Pacific Biosciences invited scientists to submit interesting genomes that they want to sequence. And then the company picks a winner and funds that kind of research.
Sandy the dingo, the desert dingo that is, won the contest. It's a purebred wild dingo. And scientists are hoping to answer questions about the relationship between dingoes and domesticated dogs and about genetic traits that may have helped domestication happen.
Other finalists, quoting from Smithsonian Magazine here, the explosive bombardier beetle, which emits a boiling hot explosive gas when attacked. You've got the pink pigeon, an endangered relative of the extinct dodo, a sea slug that steals chloroplasts from algae, and the temple pit viper, whose venom could apparently have medicinal value.
I don't know. All of those sound pretty cool. Some of them cooler than the dingo. I haven't seen their genomes.
Right.
But, Rob, if you had to pick one of these to be your Rob Ferret spirit animal, which would you pick?
Well, obviously, the explosive bombardier beetle. It sounds like that guy's would be a blast at parties.
Boiling hot explosive gas when attacked.
that's a useful skill.
You can't
skill.
Go wrong.
It's a useful skill. I would know from their genomes, though, honestly, if I saw them in print.
This is Central Time.